Sudanese people have died because of that, much more than Baluch, but as peace causes build force and fire, I think it is possible that congressional outrage and grassroots outrage could overturn the acquiescence of this government in the oppression of the Baluch and the genocide of Sudan. I would also like to point out from the Sudan cause, Fakir Taha is here from the Nubian people, who is supporters at the rally today as well, which is one of the tribes oppressed in Sudan. The conference, the nuclear program, and the dangers of it in Pakistan. My willingness to accept this invitation was based on actually my experience in Pakistan a long time ago. I happened to, when I was working with the Afghan resistance, and during the 1980s, I was kidnapped for a 78-day period by the Pakistani Intelligence Service. There's three or four people who have heard this story. But the interesting story from that applies here, is one of the officers, Pakistani officers, who was talking to me during my imprisonment, bragged about a secret plan to destroy Israel that Pakistan had. I said, "Oh, what secret plan is that?" He demurred. He would not give more details. But as I later learned from American diplomats who were stationed in Pakistan at the time, they were very concerned about the facilities at a place called Kahuta, which was the beginning of the Pakistani nuclear program, and Muammar Gaddafi was funding it at that time, who also had ambitions for the Islamic bomb. I sent a letter to that regard to several people in the United States when I came back, but I got no response from the American-Israeli Public Affairs Council or my own congressman, so I let it go. I was not focused on that. But that program went on. Even after 9/11, when Al-Qaeda and Taliban's and Iran's goals became understood to be the dangers that they were, A.Q. Khan, in the year 2003, he was one of the organizers and developers of Pakistan's nuclear capability, was involved in shipping nuclear technology to build nuclear weapons to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. And that was 2003. Now, there are countries like France and England who have nuclear weapons and were not particularly frightened or concerned over that. But within Pakistan, we have what has been developing is a systematic organization of hatred, which, by that I mean the organization of the hatreds of society to such an intense level that it reaches genocidal force. Some people feel the small end of it, like the Christians of Pakistan, who spoke a little earlier here, who get their churches are frequently bombed and people are assassinated and so forth. But systematic organization of hatred is someone able to do mass murder. And the Pakistanis had a fascination, the officers that I met had a fascination with the German military. Just recently, a few years ago, there was a photos of a rally in Islamabad. It says, "God bless Hitler." It was one of the signs being carried in the rally in Islamabad. There was a fellow in Spiegel, journalists from the famous German magazine, who when he would travel in Pakistan, he was quite shocked when he would be in a bar shop in a restaurant and they found out he was from Germany. "Oh, you're from Germany. Well, we were here too," which he found a little bit disconcerting. The German, I think, was not as popular in Germany as he once was. I was Googling trying to find that Spiegel article and found this for this talk here. So the nuclear program in Pakistan represents a real danger, and in my opinion, because of the enormous sleeping hatred that is built up artificially in Pakistan. There's a lot of dimensions to it. For example, in the simple matter of Pakistani aid to U.S. aid to Pakistan, there was a congressional hearing 1 month ago, which I happened to attend. It was the government oversight committee on the House side discussing aid to Pakistan. And Congress was telling each other at the meeting, no recipient of U.S. foreign aid since World War II has ever been so ungrateful and resentful of the U.S. aid as Pakistan. So Congress already knows that. This is it's ground that we do not have to create. The Baluch cause has an opportunity here to tap that congressional resentment of giving $7.5 billion aid program. It's a $7.5 billion aid program to Pakistan currently, to cut that off and to do that in solidarity and support of Baluch independence, Punjabi human rights, Pashtun independence, for the freedom of all the people in Pakistan, so this systematic organizational hatred, which contains such a nuclear threat within it, can be put to an end. So good luck on your cause for freedom. Every American depends on you.
I'm waiting for a friend, Dr. Baluch. He came all the way. Yeah, it seemed like he was here. He came for this event, and he's still not here, and I don't know how to proceed. I have his speech here. If you give me the permission, I can read it, because I'm not sure if he will show up. It seems like he won't. So please give me the permission to read his speech. It's a very, very nice speech here that he wrote. Dr. Zafar Baluch has been an activist for almost a quarter century. He is now in Toronto, and he is the president of the Baluch Human Rights Council of Canada. And just as I said, he came with a friend last night, and I'm now missing him. I don't know. I can't interrupt this meeting. I hope he will understand what's going on. His title is Free Baluchistan is the Hope for Peace. Pakistan's nuclear weapons program is an extension of its state ideology of Islamic expansionism, dominance, and militarism in South Asia. And like the state itself, Pakistan's nuclear arsenal is a source of terror and instability in the region. This is not a coincidence that Pakistan's nuclear bomb has been dubbed as the Islamic bomb, and each and every ballistic missile tested so far is named after Muslim invaders, Ghori, Ghaznavi, and Abdali, to name a few. Mard-e-Momin is a military tank, a term that means Muslim superman, and borrowed from Pakistan's official state philosopher, Allama Iqbal. The only objective of these Ghoris, Ghaznavis, and Momins is to hoist the Pakistani flag over New Delhi. This is the Pakistani military mindset that has remained unchanged over the last six decades. 12 years ago, on May 28, 1998, Pakistan successfully conducted its first nuclear test in the Chagi Hills in Baluchistan. Exactly a year later, on May 8, 1999, Pakistan Army's Special Forces had crossed the line of control and entered the Indian administered Kashmir to secure the Kargil heights. The Kargil war, as we know it today, was the brainchild of General Parvez Musharraf, Pakistan's Chief of Army Staff, and Lieutenant General Mohammad Aziz, the Chief of General Staff. The motive behind the operation was to help in internationalizing the Kashmir issue and forcing India militarily to resolve the long-standing dispute on the terms and conditions favoring Pakistan's Kashmir policy. It is believed that the planning for the operation by Pakistan may have occurred about as early as the autumn of 1998. As the Kargil drama unfolded in the weeks that followed, battalions of paramilitary troops were sent to Kashmir. The total Indian troop strength in the region had reached 730,000. The buildup included the deployment of around 60 frontline aircraft. The conflict was resolved after heavy casualties from sides and with mounting international pressure, especially from the U.S., Kargil will be remembered not only for its military mission adventure by Pakistan, but as a real possibility. 2001-2002 saw Pakistan-India standoff. It was the second military standoff between India and Pakistan following the nuclear tests conducted by both the countries in 1998. On the morning of December 13, 2001, a group of five armed men attacked the Indian Parliament in New Delhi. The terrorist attack was blamed on Lashkar-e-Tayyaba and Jaish-e-Mohammed, the two Pakistan-based militant groups backed by Pakistan's intelligence agency, ISI. By January 2002, India had mobilized around 500,000 troops and 3 armored divisions on the Pakistani border, concentrated along the line of control in Kashmir. Pakistan responded likewise, deploying around 120,000 troops to that region. This was the largest buildup on the subcontinent since the 1971 war between the two countries. As the world looked upon with serious concerns for a nuclear catastrophe, pressure mounted on the nuclear rivals from all corners, including United States and the United Nations, to exercise restraint, and attempts were made to defuse the situation. The Kargil War and the 2002 India-Pakistan standoff shall always remain as important reminders in the annals of military history of the subcontinent that the possibility of a nuclear disaster is real and the signs are all over the place. The dilemma with Pakistan today is that the very ideology that created the state based on Islamic identity has become its mortal enemy. The Pakistani nuclear arsenal, supposedly developed to save the state from an infidel India, is being challenged by Islamic extremism and a wave of suicide bombings from within. India-focused Pakistani military at present is deeply entangled in the web of its own creation, fighting a war against its own people in North Waziristan, where nuclear bombs are not only useless as a weapon of deterrence, but these strategic crown jewels need to be safeguarded from falling into the wrong hands. 12 years after the first nuclear test in the Chagi Hills, Pakistan military is less capable of defending the state and its institutions. The study commissioned by the Nuclear Threat Initiative and released by Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs found that Pakistan faces formidable risk in safeguarding its nuclear warheads. The study states, while acknowledging substantial security improvements in the last few years, the study notes that the danger to the nuclear program persists from the nuclear insiders with extremist sympathies, Al-Qaeda or Taliban, outside attacks, and the weak state. In fact, the history of recent developments in Pakistan shows that all the factors mentioned in the report is correct, plus a couple of extra ones could be added to it. I believe that there is a substantial possibility of an accidental nuclear war between Pakistan and India. which came, the most potent case against Pakistan's nuclear program is that the bomb is already in the wrong hands, thanks to Dr. A.Q. Khan's network and his nuclear business deals with Iran, Libya, and North Korea. Documents provided by Iran to the United Nations nuclear inspectors in November 2003 have exposed the outlines of a vast secret procurement network that successfully acquired thousands of sensitive parts and tools from numerous countries over a 17-year period. Pakistani individuals and companies are strongly implicated as sources of key blueprints, technical guidance, and equipment for a pilot uranium enrichment plant. The serious nature of the discoveries prompted a decision by Pakistan to detain three of its top nuclear scientists for several days of questioning, with U.S. intelligence experts allowed to assist. Of course, Pakistan continues to insist that it never wittingly provided nuclear assistance to Iran or anyone else. Pakistan claims that the Khan nuclear network has been dismantled after the grounding of the father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb for his bad business behavior. But access to him for any further investigation by the U.S. experts has been denied. Pakistan is the only country in the world where the Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and the nuclear bomb exist within a radius of 100 kilometers. The terrorists who are seeking a nuclear device won't even need a visa or take an international flight to acquire their goods. According to a report by Sean Gregory, director of Pakistan Security Research Unit, University of Bradford, Pakistan's nuclear facilities have been attacked at least three times by homegrown extremists over the last 3 years. The incidents include an attack on a nuclear missile storage facility at Sargodha on November 1, 2007, a homicide bombing at the nuclear air base at Kamra on December 10, 2007, and an attack at the Wak Atonement Ordnance Complex, widely understood to be one of Pakistan's main nuclear weapons assembly sites. In addition to that, Pakistan is facing a wave of terrorist attacks, including suicide bombings at the sensitive security facilities. In October 2009, Pakistan Army's General Headquarters in Rawalpindi came under attack by the Taliban militants, killing six military personnel, including an army brigadier and a lieutenant colonel. The forces that are supposedly responsible for safeguarding the nuclear arsenal are not safe themselves from attacks by the Islamic militants. I would also like to draw your attention to Balochistan, the test site for nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles by Pakistan Army. Balochistan is an occupied land forcefully annexed by the Pakistan military in 1948. People of Balochistan for the last six decades are fighting for the right to become an independent nation. The Baloch are a secular and peace-loving nation opposed to wars with neighbors and weapons of mass destruction. We strongly believe that our freedom from the Islamic State of Pakistan will develop a new balance in the region that will favor an end to global terrorism, nuclear disasters, and wars. Liberated Balochistan is the only hope for a world free from nuclear terrorism. This was by Zafar Baloch, President Baloch Human Rights Council of Canada. And as I said, he's now somewhere here, but I don't know where. I'm feeling as if I should have not have let him go at all. And Jacqueline in here, my friend. In the very end, I would ask Laurie Deemer, who has been a great support for the American Friends of Balochistan. She is a member of the Presiding Council of the American Friends of Balochistan. She spoke at the United Nations Human Rights Commission side meeting in Geneva in March this year. And we are very proud to have Laurie with us in our struggle. I will ask Laurie to please come and read.
Good afternoon, everyone. A cursory literary analysis of the work of poet Mansour Baloch highlights his portrayal of a fisherman, who through his constant crying is mistakenly thought to be mad with the factors he weeps for a cause. He weeps because he thinks of Balochistan. He imagines that everything is weeping, including the deep impassable sea which is filled with his tears of blood. The poet's graphic characterization of his grieving homeland is all too appropriate for the occasion we mark today. For today we join him in mourning Balochistan's losses resulting from the leadership of Pakistan's nuclear test initiative at Shaggy Hill 12 years ago. We mourn the fundamental loss of Baloch liberty which undergirded the decision to test, and the loss of entitlement to basic human rights already in short supply in the underdeveloped province. We mourn the decrease in quality of human life, which is the inevitable outcome of jeopardizing the quantity and quality of a region's water supply, and as experienced by compromising global agriculture, an increase in cancerous skin conditions, and the loss of scenic beauty. As one resident reminisced, people used to go to Raspo Mountain for a picnic day. It was a beautiful place where wildlife was a spectacle in itself. They sent away the people living in the area and restricted the access to everyone else. And so we also mourn the departure of that wildlife, yet another sign of ecological devastation. I must tell you that as an American, and therefore a citizen of the First Nation, to both test and conduct an attack using nuclear weapons in 1945, I feel like somewhat of a hypocrite. I am native to a country which has perpetrated nuclear testing-related injustices on its own, and therefore I broach this subject with humility. And as a citizen of the nation which provided nuclear reactors, and according to some sources, has continued to provide material assistance to aid Islamabad in guarding its nuclear material, warheads, and laboratories, I tread lightly. However, as one writer asserted on this awful anniversary, it is important that we relate the past of the present to the past. And to his assertion, I would also add, we ought to use today's forum to reflect on what motivated our respective countries to conduct nuclear tests and to somberly prepare for future policy making in an independent Balochistan. It has been suggested that the United States is motivated to begin developing nuclear weapons during World War II. I fear that we were engaged in a race with Nazi Germany to produce such a weapon. The 1945 atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki generated ethical debate among U.S. citizens, as some of us wanted to believe that the bombings hastened the end of the war with Japan, though it seemed difficult to fathom that the ends justified the means. In the 50s, we felt threatened by the Soviet Union and hoped that nuclear weapons would diminish that threat. In the 60s and 70s, the inherent dangers of nuclear testing and facility maintenance finally compelled us to protest publicly. And although this trend continued into the 80s, it has been concluded that the majority of Americans believed weapons were required for U.S. national security. Quite honestly, the 9/11 attacks simultaneously intensified our collective need for secure borders and served as a deeply unpleasant reminder that, in fact, no nation is completely secure, regardless of the size and sophistication of its weaponry. I can speak to Pakistan's rationale for testing with even less authority. However, some blame Prime Minister Bhutto's hubris, accusing him of relying on the bomb to save him from the consequences of its failure to govern. Others claim the decision to test on May 28th was a direct response to palpable Israeli and Indian threats against the physical nuclear infrastructure at Kahuta. Some believe it was defense against India or a quest for international respect. Others label it an offensive move against India. And still others suggest that the motive was to build national pride and unite people groups in conflict. Most commentators seem to feel that Islamabad not only failed miserably in its stated mission to unite the citizens of Pakistan, but that its leaders' decision to test nuclear weapons ultimately thwarted this mission and drove the culture deeper, drove the culture itself deeper into self-destruction and fanaticism. In the end, neither the United States nor Islamabad has managed to assuage its own fears about national security. The issue of nuclear testing generates division rather than unity among its respective citizens. Both governments continue to pay retribution of one kind or another to their victims, and their victims, whether they live in the vicinity of American test sites or dwell in the Chaggy Hills of occupied Balochistan, continue to suffer the negative effects of detonation on their health and homelands. Now, coincidentally, today's memorial also marks the conclusion of a month-long United Nations conference wherein the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty is being revisited. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon began the conference on May 3rd by pushing to set a deadline for activating the treaty, thereby stepping up pressure in a campaign to win over the nuclear powers, which have not yet signed or ratified. Two of the holdouts include the United States, a signatory since 1996, still awaiting ratification by the U.S. Senate, and Pakistan, which has signed neither the Non-Proliferation Treaty or the UN's Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I hereby respectfully call on President Obama to resubmit the President or the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Pact to Congress. I humbly urge my United States senators to unanimously ratify the treaty so that our delegates to the United Nations are in a better position to advocate for a safer world. And as a small but significant gesture of making amends to the Native Americans and other U.S. citizens damaged by the testing. And I respectfully ask my leaders to maintain the current moratorium on nuclear testing. As an American friend of the Baloch, I humbly call on Islamabad to sign the Non-Proliferation and Comprehensive Test Ban Treaties. And in keeping with the American Friends of Balochistan mission statement, I also respectfully urge Islamabad to halt preparations for nuclear testing in the Dadaan region. To the Baloch people, both those of the diaspora and those on the ground, I say now is the time, though you are in the very midst of your struggle for independence, to determine the ethics by which you will demonstrate your power as a nation, particularly as it impacts upon the safeguarding of its citizens. May you also be inspired by the poet whose work I referenced at the beginning of the presentation, where he goes on to say that though he grieved for Balochistan, such that its seas were filled with tears of blood, he has not given up hope. And although he had lost his way, he saw in the dark the legs of the martyrs, and imagine that the darkness would eventually be replaced by a gleaming light. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.